which isn't deterred. It seems absurd. You get what you deserve, but a reason to believe is a formula that works. Spend an afternoon doing what you like. It's a good life. Sit tight and enjoy the ride into the night. We're saying that it's wise, but the wordplay ratio isn't always kind. She wanted to be some way.
Greetings one and all, and a very warm welcome to this evening's Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes or so, I'll be able to call in tonight's guest, who is an ex-policeman who has worked his way to, I think, several very interesting solutions to start tackling some of the problems that we all know we face. Last tune we heard was Efficient Waste of Time by Smiling Ivy, a band that I first caught earlier on this year at the Landed Festival. Apparently they've been around for many years and have quite a lot of stuff out there. And well, when I get a moment, chase down a few more of their tunes. Well, we seem to be getting everything from the highest to the lowest, really, at the moment. I'm amazed by the kind of swings in mind I get listening to Sean Maguire's fabulous show last night, and that lady who had her children removed ostensibly because she was irresponsible and didn't have any car tax, so they held her for 10 hours or so, and whilst that was going on, they nipped into the school and had her children away. Absolutely outrageous. Fantastic radio voice, really great individual, I thought, and seems that she managed to work her way around that with a bit of help from presumably somebody in the MSI chat box. Really great to hear. Even more bizarre, I was given earlier on a link to an article from the Daily Record, I think in Scotland, saying that there's a bartender up there facing a criminal charge after serving two cops a single roll and a sausage with a morning pint. Because apparently there's a rule up there that says that if you're going to open, some people are allowed a special license, apparently, to open early in the morning and serve beer to people who are just coming out of work. They never used to do that when I was working night shifts, but one of the rules is that if you're going to do that, you have to serve people food to go with the pint, and this bloke was apparently a little bit rushed off his feet. A cook was missing or something, and there was only one sausage and a bun ready, so he served two pints and a single sausage. And he was arrested for contravening strict early opening rules, which insist drinks can only be served with food. A pair of undercover officers, apparently. I don't know what they were doing in there, drinking pints at that time of the morning. I wonder how many places they'd been to before they found somebody who was only serving a single sausage. Father of three lost his job at the Empire Bar in Glasgow over the snack incident and is now being dragged through the courts on a criminal charge. Apparently a criminal charge, only serving a single sausage. I reckon there's every chance if you pulled the sausage over and gave it a quick check, you'd probably find that that was a greater offence than only serving one of them. Absolutely bizarre, really, and I just keep getting more and more of this stuff coming across my desktop. It does seem sometimes to be getting entirely out of hand, really. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com, where we are, as the man says, seeking solutions. And tonight I'm really lucky to have with me Dave Eden, who's one of the moving spirits behind the Community Press Group, which is, I ran into him at the Unity Earth Dance that you heard me and Sean talking about the other day. And hopefully Dave's with me live on the line. Can you hear me all right, Dave?
I can indeed.
Very good. Well, it's all looking good here. So, you, from what I remember, you've been a policeman really most of your work in life, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, all my adult life really. I joined the Met in 1982. Left police in 2009. Most of my service with the Met, the last sort of 9, 10 years with Hertfordshire. Yeah, so I mean, it's principally all I know.
Yeah, did you move from the Met to Hertfordshire? Was that your own volition, or were you sort of moved on by the force, as it were?
Oh no, they don't change your forces. They can't do that. But no, very quickly, all it was is that I was in an area of the Metropolitan Police that was taken over by Hertfordshire in a boundary change, and they put us on loan to Hearts for a couple of years, and I just decided to stay because I really didn't fancy the travelling back into central London. So, you know, it was no more complicated than that.
And to start with, presumably you are happy with the police and what it was doing, were you?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, you know, people say, why do you want to join the police force? You know, are you a borderline sociopath, so on and so forth. And, you know, we all have images of it, young and naive. I didn't want to join the county force because I'd watched Juliet Bravo, but, I wanted to join the Met to fight real crime and drive around in Granada sort of attitude. That sort of pretty soon knocked out of you when you start to realise the reality of it. And it didn't take me long to realise the reality of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and what was it that first drew your attention to the fact that it wasn't quite what you were expecting?
Well, you know, you came out of training school, which is a bit of a false environment. Straight onto division, there was a couple of things that really shocked me. Very quick story on my first day of service, I was sent to a domestic dispute. I'd got no knowledge of anything. I was there, with an older, more experienced cop that was puppy walking me. He clearly didn't like having to do that. The lady, unfortunately, had been quite badly assaulted as part of this domestic. Now, in those days, police didn't intervene in domestic disputes. Now, his answer to it was, make me a cup of tea. And after he'd had his cup of tea and pretty much ignored everything she'd said, it was a case of, right, you know, it's three things you can do, love. You knit him back, you can pack your bags, we'll wait while you do it, or you can commit suicide, you know, good night.
Good Lord.
So, that was a bit of an eye-opener. And, you know, it wasn't long after that we stopped a vehicle. And we went through all the reasons why we were stopping it. And, I couldn't come up with just, what the reason was. And, he says to me, well, who's driving? Some bloke. Who's in the passenger seat? Some girl. What colour's the bloke? Oh, black. What colour's the girl? White. Well, why are we stopping it? Black and white ain't right. And so it was that sort of thing, and you suddenly realised that, there's another incident where I had to ask how to do something, and, a guy picked up a telephone and bounced the receiver off my head several times while he spelled out the word telling bone. And I sort of realised that you either became part of the canteen culture and the culture of it, or you were either bellicose and part of it, or you became a victim of it, you became bullied, and I certainly wasn't going to be in the latter category. So you wear this facade and you go along with it.
Yeah. And so what was your response? Presumably you had to come up with a way of dealing with this, which wasn't just knuckling under, did you?
Well, no, I didn't knuckle under. As I said, you have to wear the facade. You know, if you weren't a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, or if you weren't a bully towards anyone that was different, you know, somebody that was fat, somebody that was bald, somebody that was too thin, so everything, you know, it's passed off as humour, but a lot of it was sort of bullying, let's face it. I then got married. I married a local girl who was an Asian girl, and we went up to Gretna Green, got married. And it was just something one of my colleagues said to me one day. He said, you know, we're not being funny, Dave, but some of the lads have said they prefer it if you didn't bring your missus to the Christmas do. And, you know, it's not long after the Southall riots and there's still a bit of ill feeling and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, screw this. And so I started evidencing things. I mean, I've got some stuff now which I've got dating back to 1984, things that appeared on the walls of police stations, and I assure you I have thought about publishing them. You know, one of them makes constant reference to the N-word and poofs and this, that and the other and so on and so forth. If that went on the walls of the police station today, somebody would go to prison for it. You know, we're not talking about losing your job. These, you know, it was that outrageous. And I used to take these things down after they had the time up there, and I used to file them away, and I've still got them. I've still got the originals now. And so I just started through my service. I started to witness things and write things down. And you know, to my great, great shame, I have to say, you know, you go along to get along sort of thing. And you don't certainly, when you're the bottom of the rung, you know, bottom rung of the ladder, you don't want to stand out. You don't want to make yourself a victim. And you sort of like, you have your own opinions, but you go along with the majority. And, you know, I do have regrets about that. I can't turn the clock back. I was that person to an extent. I should have done more, certainly in my early service, but you just didn't do it in those days. And even now, if the truth be told, you don't even do it these days. You know, the facade of the police force is all now so very, very, very diverse. And, you know, you start scratching away that facade and you'll find out that it isn't. It's, you know, the same things are still going on. It's just that they're now going on in very much a stealth mode.
Right. So the actual culture remains the same. It's just the facade of it that's changed.
Yeah, largely the culture does remain the same. You know, unfortunately, because of diversity, and, you know, I'm not in any way criticizing diversity. I like to think I am extremely diverse. I mean, obviously, I've got, you know, two girls that are Anglo-Indian and so on and so forth. And, you know, I do embrace diversity, as corny as that sounds. I do believe. But because what's happened is people find themselves in, you know, vying for positions that suddenly get taken by somebody else. And even though that other person may be the best person for the role, the fact that they're a female, the fact that they're gay, the fact that they're black or so on and so forth, you know, is seen as being by a lot of people are seen as, well, that's the factor why they've got that job. And so, you know, it's in stealth mode and it's discussed, you know, away from the police station, and there's resentment there. And in fact, diversity largely doesn't truly exist.
Mm. So when did it start getting serious? When did you start actually finding stuff that you felt you needed to report to superior officers?
Well, I started to find, you know, the stuff that we're talking about, I started to see other things that were going on that really shouldn't have been going on, poor practices, malpractice, downright out-and-out corruption, I suppose, and, you know, certainly dishonesty. And I thought, you know, I've had enough of this, and so I started to challenge things. And that got me absolutely nowhere. There was a very well-known case, and I'm not going to talk about this case because it's wrong to talk about it, because unfortunately somebody that's involved in the case is now very sadly deceased, the victim of a murder, and she's not here to defend herself, and therefore I don't have the right, I don't feel, to sort of make judgment. But all I can say is that this person was involved in a series of events that evidence to me that they were involved in levels of criminality, certainly very unacceptable levels of criminality, and had links to very senior officers within the Metropolitan Police Force. This person was representative or employee of the police service themselves. In fact, they were a special constable. And I made the reports known. I submitted all the necessary reports. I did everything I should do. I made contact directly with the people that were identified to me, and nothing happened. And unfortunately, after the sad murder of this individual, I then made all this information known to the murder squad, and all investigations into the links, the criminality that was going on, all investigations into the links to the senior personnel were stopped. Nothing ever happened, and they wouldn't do anything about it, and they refused to do anything about it, and it was simply buried.
And at that point, I guess it became apparent that it was actually directly being protected by senior officers who, I presume, supposedly have responsibility for dealing with stuff like this.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, when we use the word presume or we suppose, I mean, supposition is exactly that. It's supposition, you know, it's not definitive and it's not empirical. I don't like to go down those realms. I know what I think. I know what happened. But unless I can definitively prove something, I never make any allegations. We can read between the lines and see very clearly what happened. You know, there are other things that I can actually evidence and prove that happened. And I can talk about those quite openly, because I've challenged them. I've challenged them publicly. I've challenged them through contacts in the mainstream media. I've challenged them direct with senior representatives of the police force and got absolutely nowhere. And the good thing is the fact that I'm now no longer a police officer, that is what made me realise that I've actually got a lot more power outside of the service to influence what's going on than I did inside the service.
Yeah, I guess so, because there's a lot of people closing ranks inside there, which is harder for them to do, presumably, if you're outside pissing in, as we say.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that, you know, this target-driven policing was a huge issue for me.
I was really shocked when you outlined that in your little presentation at the Earth Dance. Because you gave some details as to just exactly what targets people are expected to hit every month. Could you go through those with us?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, target-driven policing was incredibly divisive. The manner in which it was employed was often downright criminal, in my opinion. Principally, chief constables are set targets by ACPO. They have to achieve these targets on an annual basis to ensure that they maintain competency, so on and so forth. One of them is always the reduction of crime. Second one is diversity. And there's usually four, five or six other targets, as a result of which the chief constables will receive bonuses. The average chief constable receives a bonus of 15% of their annual salary, then going down right to the ranks of area commander, it's structured sort of like 12.5%, 10%, so on and so forth. Now, the officers in my unit were given targets. At the time, that was roads policing or traffic, as it's more commonly known. And they were given a target of 4 arrests a month, 4 vehicle seizures a month, 15 non-endorsable tickets, 15 endorsable tickets, 1 dangerous driving, 1 cannabis warning, 1 public order offence, minimum.
So that's incredibly specific. And you had about 50 people on your team, is that right?
The actual establishment of that was 52 officers at the time, 52 police constables, 5 sergeants, or no, 6 sergeants, 2 inspectors. Now, you know, you can't say these targets didn't exist, because they did exist. They were on the wall. They, you know, somebody went so far as to bloody laminate them and stick them on the wall so everybody knew what they had to achieve. Yeah. And of course, that, you know, people didn't meet the targets, then you know, there was consequences of not meeting your targets.
Mm-hmm.
So people went out to meet their targets using any methodology that they could try.
And I did the sums on that. That's effectively, it means that irrespective of what you actually come across when you're out there in the course of your duties, your team or your group of men is expected to make effectively 2,000, over 2,000 charges a month. I'll work that out to be.
No, it won't be 200, won't it? 52 times 4 is 204.
Yeah, indeed.
208. But if you... 208, that's 208 arrests a month, and then you've got all of the others. Yeah, you're talking a lot, let's put it that way. But the problem is for these people to get it, because not only have they got those targets to achieve, they've got to deal with everything else that's coming in. You know, we've got a major action on the M1, this has happened, that's happened. So they've got to achieve all this within, you know, the working month. And what I found was that there was an awful lot of very questionable, if not downright unlawful, arrests being made. People using the high-powered unmarked cars we have, and pay-as-you-go mobile phone to look for sign-written vehicles driving along the motorway. They'd then ring the vehicle to see if the driver answered, and when he did, get into a position where they could film in, light the car up like a Christmas tree, turn their phone off, and come on down, you've won a major prize. And that's another target.
Absolutely, you know, shocking.
Yeah, we'd got people arresting school-run mums. You know, there's the ANPR vehicles, the automatic number plate recognition equipped vehicles. You know, they'll read the number plate of a car. They'll tell you that it's insured. They'll tell you it's taxed. They'll tell you the persons that are insured to drive it, the address they live at, their driving license details, so on and so forth. And it got to the stage where, you know, these ladies were being stopped. and looked at, well, let's have a look at your driving license, Mrs. Smith. Oh, I see you've got 3 points. Did you tell your insurance company that? Oh, no, you didn't. Oh, what a shame. We're going to have to arrest you for obtaining services by deception.
Really?
So, yeah, and oddly enough, during these things, these people were actually never formally charged with the offences because there wasn't a single insurance company that was willing to give evidence about that. But what they did get is they got cautions, official cautions. Now, an official caution counts as what's known as sanctioned detection. And a sanctioned detection is what is added up in terms of this is how much crime we've solved.
Right.
And so there we are, we have just solved another crime. Yahoo. And aren't we wonderful?
It's a crime which, like Sean says in the chat box, you were effectively creating using your technologies.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's precisely what was happening. Now, I did a stint as a custody officer. I wasn't the most popular custody officer in the world, certainly when people brought prisoners in to me because they knew that I wasn't going to listen to any old crap that was said to me, and if the evidence wasn't 100% right, and if the necessity, the what they call Code G of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, if that wasn't there, and they couldn't sort of justify the necessity for arrest, then there would be some issues.
Yeah.
I'll give you a very quick example of one of those things, and this should have never happened. I had a guy brought in to me with it was presented to me as allegation of suspected ABH, actual bodily harm. The gentleman had an injury on his head. He'd obviously been struck quite hard on the head. He'd got a significant injury on his head. I listened to the evidence. The necessity was presented to me. You know, the criteria for the necessity was there. So I accepted him into custody. I made sure a doctor came to see him. I gave him, you know, obviously went through all his rights and everything. And he requested to be interviewed. Now, what tends to happen is people that are brought in late at night, one of the things under Code G that people are arresting for, you know, it says for the prompt and effective investigation of the offence. Now, a lot of the police forces, or the majority of the police forces, regularly, hundreds of times, if not thousands of times a day, breach the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. Because what they do is they say, oh no mate, you're now in a rest period, you're going to be bedded down for 8 hours and somebody in the morning will interview you. Well, actually that's not the case, because if that person is sober, they're not under the influence of drugs or alcohol and they're fit for interview, they can say, no thank you very much, you've brought me here for you know, prompt and effective investigation. As in this case, there was only one other witness or one other party. Let's crack on with it. So I said, right, go and get the statement and come back and interview him. Big arguments with the officers involved. Their super line managers got involved, arguments with them. I said, look, do it or I kick him out. He's gone. He's out of here. End of story.
Yeah.
They eventually did it. They brought me this statement back. I read through it, and it was very clear from the statement that this guy wasn't the guy that committed an assault. In fact, he was the victim of an assault. They interviewed him. I sent the paperwork off to what they call CPS Direct, which is the Crown Prosecution Service that works throughout the night, and they came back and said, no offence, no charge, and I made them drive him home. On his way out, he shook hands with me, and he said, you know, thanks a lot, Sarge. You've done everything totally by the book. The reason that I wanted to get out in the morning, you know, because I didn't tell you at the time, but I am a solicitor, I'm a criminal defence solicitor, and I'm in court in the morning, but I, you know, I cannot fault everything that's gone on here tonight. Thank you very much. The next night I come in and there's a DI or a DCI, I can't remember what rank he was now, waiting for me to inform me that the management were extremely angry with me, and I was in hot water as I'd allowed somebody to walk out without a caution.
Right.
So we'd lost the sanction detection. So to which I said, well, you know, why did you let him go? I said, well, I think, you know, the small element that he wasn't guilty of an offence did play a part in that decision. Well, you could have got a caution out of him and they're not happy about it. And I let him ramble on. And eventually I said to him, right, okay, then what we'll do is I've got his contact details. If you want to pop down to Hartenden or get, you know, one of the superintendent or somebody to pop down to Hartenden to invite him in for a caution, I'm sure he's happy to be coming and be cautioned. I think I ought to tell you first, though, that the chap is a criminal solicitor. Oh, well, why didn't you tell us that in the first place? Oh, like that makes any difference. So we wouldn't have cautioned him because he'd have known what we were doing was wrong.
Yeah.
Is that what you're telling me? This conversation's over sort of attitude. And, you know, and that's going on day in, day out in custody stations across the United Kingdom, and it's unacceptable. Now, you know, what I did, I collated all this evidence and I tried to see the assistant chief constable but wasn't permitted in. Got fobbed off with the chief superintendent and I gave him a big pile. I said, all of those are unlawful arrests. All of those tickets are issued unlawfully and are the consequence of entrapment. They're running a competition at, you called the Bang It Out Cup and the underperforming pick. So the officer that gets the most gets his name put on the cup. The officer that gets the least gets this pig, and he's, you know, mated all the crap jobs for the next few weeks, certainly for the next month and so on and so forth. So it's all divisive. It's all unlawful. This needs to be managed. It needs challenging and something needs doing about it. Without boring your listeners too much, I was basically told to get out of the office. And nothing ever was done about it. And then, you know, Kel Surprise, it all had to come out in the Sunday newspapers, including pictures of the underperforming pig and the Bang It Out Cup.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing was about that, when Hertfordshire Constabulary were approached about it, they denied all of it, including the cup and the pig. I know from officers that were subsequently briefed by an inspector that they were told this had never happened, to deny it, and so on and so forth. And, of course, there you are. That's the next day in the Sunday papers. There's the pictures of it with the names of the officers on the cup.
That must be pretty unusual for it to make it out into the public, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's what you've got to do. I mean, you know, like people say, oh, you know, whistleblowers, I don't like whistleblowers, I don't like this and so on and so forth. That's fine. You know, people can say, well, you're a whistleblower, and that's fine. Yeah, maybe I am a whistleblower. But the point is, if there aren't people that are prepared to stand up and say, no, you know, I'll stare you in the face, I'm not going to back down, this is wrong, this needs to be held to account, I've given you opportunities to bring this, you know, to bring the people responsible to account, and you've refused to do so, you'd leave me no alternative. And that's what, you know, that is my feelings about it.
Yeah, and were you kind of unique in this? Was there anybody else kind of doing this sort of stuff?
No, not really.
No,
but not saying that they wouldn't have done that sort of stuff and they didn't feel that sort of way. You know, I think people, we all need to understand there's a certain vulnerability, certainly from the rank and file officers. You know, it's very easy for the management of the police service to make their lives extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, there are penalties to be paid for, you know, taking that course of conduct. Maybe, I don't know what it was. I just, to me it's completely unconscionable and I'm prepared to pay those prices. And I will stare them in the face. I will say what I've got to say. I will bring out what I'm going to do. I will challenge it, and I will suffer the consequences of it. And that's, you know, that's just driven what I believe, basic morality and humanity. You know, I'm certainly not, you know, now I'm outside of the service, so I'm not going to start criticising the rank and file officers of the police service, because I've worked with some exceptional police officers, people whose real concerns were for members of the public.
Yeah.
And those people are out there. Unfortunately, they're not allowed to function so much as they used to do, because it's not about service delivery. It's not about doing a good job. It's about generating figures. It's about accountability. And then the police, they go on with these completely disingenuous mission statements. And, you know, this is our mission, vision, and so on and so forth, and they espouse accountability and openness and transparency. And there could be nothing further from the truth. You know, I had a friend of mine. I had to go to a meeting about the huge number of vehicles that were being unlawfully seized. Massive numbers of vehicles being unlawfully seized. And I had the meeting with the people that were in charge of the vehicle recovery unit and so on and so forth, vehicle seizure officer. And he said, you know, what are the issues? And we went through the issues and the fact that target-driven police had been behind it, so on and so forth. So I had a friend of mine, a journalist, for one of the nationals, send a Freedom of Information request to Hertfordshire Constabulary asking them, can you tell us how many vehicles have been seized, and then, you know, it's been proved that they were insured or the drivers did have the necessary licences, so on and so forth. And they wrote back saying that they didn't collate such information. They had no records. Complete lie.
Yeah, I mean, everything's recorded. I mean, just according to what you've told us, your team must have been expected to remove 200 vehicles a month, effectively, or something in that order.
Absolutely. And a lot of them were removed, and a lot of them were removed unlawfully, and still are being removed unlawfully. And the thing is, the officers themselves aren't even sure of the legislation a lot of the time. The number of times I've had them say to me, you know, I've seen tax tickets that they've written and things like this. You know, I had suspicion that the vehicle was not insured. Well, actually, if you read the legislation, it's not about suspicion. It doesn't say anywhere in there that they suspect the vehicle is uninsured. It says that you have to have reasonable grounds for believing. Now, that's a whole different ballgame.
You can believe what you like, can't you?
Well, yeah, but then you've got to justify that belief. I mean, you know, let's face it, people believe in God. They don't suspect in God.
Yeah, good point, yeah.
You know, you believe in God because it's a belief, and you have to have a reason to have that belief, and that belief tends to be, you know, a combination of an intellectual and emotional belief. You know, it is an intellectual and emotional commitment. So, you know, the answer to that is, you know, what was your intellectual and emotional commitment to the belief that this person had no insurance? You can't say, because it's not shown on the national insurance database, that it's not shown on the PNC, because that is, you know, it's provably that it's hugely inaccurate. So, yeah, you know, you cannot use that as a point of reference. You have to have some reason. And the reason, you know, a lot of the time was, I believe I need to get another vehicle seized to hit my targets.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to hit your targets to not get yourself into trouble and to continue to get your superior officers their bonuses, basically.
Absolutely. That's the police service. I could bore the arse off everyone about the police service all day long. But it's not about the police service anymore. You know, I left the police service in the late 1980s. I start to become aware of, I won't go into details of this because it's just not necessary, but I worked in a specialist department. I saw a lot of the comings and goings. I saw a lot of comings and goings of people that I couldn't recognise and identify and think, well, you know, hang on a minute, why are these people getting police protection? Why are these people here? What are they doing? Who are they? And I started researching them. And then I started to get interested in the more holistic picture. And over the years, like everyone else, I've gone through UN Agenda 21, persistent chemtrails, so on and so forth, all of those things.
Yeah.
And it was a case of, you know, what am I going to do with this knowledge? Because there's so many people out there with the knowledge. But what are we actually doing with this knowledge? And, you know, what happened with me was I started to go to meetings. Small meetings, you know, 10, 12, 14, sometimes 20 people, and people would be sitting around and they'd be talking about this and, oh yeah, this is, you know, UN Agenda 21, oh, the chemtrails, they're doing this and so on and so forth. And, I don't know whether I'm allowed to use exprobation on this show, but, you know, principally, you know, it was intellectual masturbation because actually nobody was doing anything about anything. And so, you know, one day this guy sat there and, you know, he'd identified the problem and, oh, this is the resolution methodology and this is what we must do and blah, 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 blah. And I just got fed up with it and I said to him, well, do it then. Stop talking about it. Take ownership of it and do it.
Yeah.
Because this is all I'm hearing. And yeah. Well, you know, I've got kids and I've got a job and blah, blah, blah. Well, we're going on holiday to Sweden. All right, well, you know, we'll stop, you know, we'll just sort of put global meltdown on halt then while you go on holiday to Sweden, shall we? Yeah. And it was a case of, you know, I've got to look at myself and say, well, actually, you know, bear witness to myself. What am I doing about it? So I started doing some research. I looked at models in the United States. In Australia and realised that, you know, allegedly 83% of Americans now get their news from internet-based news services, and a lot of those are, in inverted commas, the alternative media. But the spread of this is through the simple technique of multi-platform sharing. a multi-platform distribution.
So that's actually a way in for solutions, isn't it? Hang on a moment, we've got this. This is the third time that Hercules has flown over this bloody static in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah. So, and I started to think about it. I thought about all these sort of groups that I was going to, and you know, whether it was 77 Believers or which I only went to once, but you know, that sort of thing. And it's like anything else. You know, you look at the military, you look at the police, you look at the government agencies. These people have all got power, and they've got power because they've got one thing in common, and that is the old adage that might is right.
Yeah.
That's what is needed. So I thought about the community press group. And really is an instrument to bring people together and to bring groups together. And not necessarily people of that are like-minded. That in itself isn't necessary. In fact, the greater the diversity, the better. But by having somewhere that can serve as a big pot from which information can be taken out on any subject by anybody and then continue to be distributed. What it does is hopefully to empower people. So you've got groups, you may have a group somewhere up in Liverpool that's looking at various things, Equities and Exchange Act, taking actions against councils or illegal bailiffs and so on and so forth. Well, you know, they're going to have some things that work and they're going to have some things that don't work. The issues are you've got somebody in Cardiff doing the same thing. You've got somebody in Sheffield and Doncaster and down in Eastbourne. But what people need to be doing is they need to be sharing this information, with some form of collective umbrella that they can come into, that they can put this information and say, well, actually, the such and such Act of 1888, if you do this and move liability to the local authorities, we found this has worked, this is the model that we used, so on and so forth, and sharing the successes, but also sharing the failures. But then that starts people talking to each other.
I think that's a very important point, because you'd effectively identified that the individuals wandering around the place giving talks was bringing people's attention to the problems, but was not enabling us to share any solutions, or indeed any failed solutions that we were trying. And that's something that I know we were talking about very much a couple of years ago. We were seeing people getting locked up for a failed method, and then 6 months down the line, we'd see somebody else getting locked up for trying exactly the same thing. So you'd identified that as a problem, and you're coming up with a solution for it effectively.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's how you get solutions, isn't it? And this is how you get information out there. I mean, in terms of the community press group, it's a very broad editorial policy, almost a non-existent editorial policy in effect. It's not about blogging. That's the thing. I've got nothing against blogging, and I think blogging is a great social tool. But you get somebody that's put something on there, and then they get the usual, oh yeah, up yours, mate. This is this, that, and the other, and so on and so forth. It's the community press group is about inviting and sort of saying to people what we need now is intelligent debate. And it doesn't matter what it is you put on there, so long as it's not libelous, so long as it's not going to breach copyright, and so long as it doesn't seek to marginalise any individual or community, well, or group of individuals, then it's acceptable. So, if somebody wants to write about creationism while somebody else wants to write about existentialism, fine. Somebody wants to write there on Greenpeace and what their opinion of, what's happening there, and, what's happening with the Russian oil rig business and so on and so forth, then that's fine. So long as somebody else has got different beliefs about it and say, well, actually, I think Greenpeace is, they're a factor. They're people that promote the global warming agenda, so on and so forth. Original narrative. It has to be original narrative. It's not cutting and pasting stuff. So let them put their opinion on there as well, because that stimulates debate. But what it does, it makes people take ownership of something. And that's what we need to do. We need to be looking at things and not just talking about it. We need to be taking ownership of that thing and saying, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find out more about that. I'm going to have an opinion about that, but I'm going to have that opinion based on information coming from different sources.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And by giving people, by saying that you're not, so long as it isn't libelous, it doesn't breach copyright and doesn't marginalise anybody, you're giving everybody a good chance to actually share their information.
Yeah, and that's what's needed. And the other thing is, you know, it's a great stimulus to feel part of something, and it's always a good thing to feel part of something that is, you know, that is greater than I.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's very important. I think one of the important things is we've got to get rid of this divisiveness, these methodologies that are out there. You know, we look at the mainstream media, we look at, you know, television news, and they start talking in terms of, you know, the Jewish community, the Asian community, the Muslim community, the whatever community, communities. And it's all communities. We're not communities. You know, we have to look at ourselves and say, yeah, we have differences. That's great. Let's celebrate those differences, let's embrace those differences, but we're all safe, we're all facing the same holistic problems.
Yeah, and one of the main ways of getting at us is definitely to be driving wedges between us. I tend to agree there, and we are all facing the same problem, aren't we? Even to a certain extent, I would guess in the long run, the police themselves, because, you know, they're normal men and women who are paying their council tax like everybody else.
Of course they are. They've got wives, they've got children, they've got parents, they're somebody's grandchildren. They're no different than anyone else. They do a job. A lot of them do it, you know, believing that they're going to do so and they're going to be doing it, you know, for real benefit of the community. That's not always the case because of the pressures that are put on them.
Mm.
You know,
Can I just ask you one or two questions that have come up in the chat box? And then Neil's keen to come in as well. So if we get through these questions, I'll play a quick 3-minute tune and get Neil in on the call. Neil Foster in on the call as well.
Brilliant, that'd be lovely.
He's keen to come and join in. So obviously feel free. These are people. It's the first chance anybody's had really to have a chat with an ex-serving policeman. So I know that we're going to be talking a little bit about the police communications systems later on. So Rich, I'll leave that one for the moment, if that's okay. We'll come back to that later. But somebody's interested in knowing about what the deal is when police attend with bailiffs for kind of for evictions and the like. Do you know anything about that?
I do indeed. Yeah, the attendance of police when bailiffs are there, the police are there for one purpose and one purpose only. They are there to ensure that a breach of the peace does not happen. That's all they are there for. They're not there to act as agents for the bailiffs. And so long as there is no breach of the peace, then the police have no other duties there and shouldn't accept or undertake any other duties.
Doesn't seem always to work out that way, does it?
I think that's a lot of the time through the naivety of the officers that are on scene. There are methodologies that you can use in these circumstances. One of the things is always do so peacefully. Don't give anybody grounds to do anything. Now, every single person, regardless of what individual police officers may tell you, we all have the right to film, to audio record police officers or other members from government agencies in public places, even if they're dealing with an incident. We all have that right. And if they try to stop us doing that, then they themselves can be guilty of offences.
Yeah.
This is part and parcel of what we do during the training days. We teach people about that. We teach people how to evidence proper things properly. This is, you know, a lot of people unfortunately don't get anywhere through the system because things aren't evidenced properly. And knowing how to evidence something properly is a great instrument, it's a great tool, and it's a great weapon. And, you know, what I'm saying to people is, yeah, let these people do what they're going to do. Let them commit themselves because they do not have the monopoly. They certainly do not have the monopoly when it comes to prosecutions. You know, people think it's only police officers or the police services that can charge somebody with an offence and bring them to court. Well, that's not the case. And we're going to show that's not the case. And we're going to show people how to make that happen, what the process is, how to put things properly, how to comply with the Criminal Justice Act. Excuse me.
So failures in procedure, effectively, giving people, leading people to believe that they can't do that, you're saying?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's not just failings in procedure, it's failings due to ignorance of the law. You know, it's failings down to human nature. But that doesn't mean to say that it's right and that it's justifiable and that it's not open for constructive challenge. And, you know, I'm a great believer in this is what we need to do, whether it's with the police service, whether it's with the social services. We need to start challenging things, but we need to start challenging things properly. You need to start being able to evidence things properly. We need to be able to say, right, we're going to bypass the DPP, we're going to bypass the Attorney General, we're going to bring these charges and we're going to take them straight into court to do so. That is what we're doing. And this is going to be a long, treacherous road.
Yeah.
However, you know, we will start to get success and people will say, well, hang on a minute,
can we now get this? Hang on a moment, Dave. It sounds like we're getting one of these Skype problems we get and your voice is breaking up at the moment. So what I'm going to do is just put a tune on and then I'll recall you and get Neil to call in as well. And we'll see if we can't get a clearer line. Good. You're listening live once again. I think we've got two guests on now. We've got Dave and one of his compadres, Neil Foster, has joined us as well. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Pleasure to be here.
Brilliant. Just a couple more questions for you then, Dave, if I could, before we move back on to the solutions offered by the community press group. Mahatma Coat in the chat box would like to know whether you've got any knowledge of activists that infiltrating alternative communities and promoting Agenda 21 from inside. Are you familiar with any of that going on?
What was it Carl Sagan said? Do aliens exist? Well, yeah, how could they not? Do infiltrators exist? How could they not? Yes, of course. This is actual policy, and they will be, infiltrators within every group, and they will come, from the least likely place. I mean, on that note, it's quite funny actually, because I did a training session recently, and to which some people rather bizarrely believed that they saw drones tracking us. And I attached a tracking device to a vehicle, or some absolute complete nonsense. And they look at me and they say, you're part of the establishment, or you were part of the establishment, you're obviously the prime suspect. But the person that is likely to be the prime suspect is somebody that's been a member of the member of the group for 2 or 3 years and has actually participated in certain activities. That's the person. And, I think by rule of thumb, you have to assume that somebody will either be a member of the security forces or in the employ of the security forces in every group, whether it's UN Agenda 21, whether it's anti-fracking and so on and so forth. Yeah. I think the short answer to that is yes.
Yeah, and you reckon it's pretty much everywhere. That's certainly my impression.
Can I add to that?
Yeah, go for it, Neil.
I think the easiest way to spot these kind of people is they're the ones that will advocate violence. That's the way to spot them.
Yeah, that's a good tip there. We certainly have noticed before that that agent provocateur do tend to want to try to do that.
They need violence, let's face it. It's what we talked about before. Passive resistance, might is right, large numbers of people voting with their actions or sometimes inactions have far more power than the more violent approach or the activist, the really overt activist approach, because that's what they're equipped for. That's what the military are there for. That's what the police are there for. That's why they've, over the last few years, we've seen the militarisation of the police forces. They're swanning around in body armour and tasers and so on and so forth, because that's what they want, because that is what is so easy to crush. And they can crush it, and they can crush it quickly, and they can crush it dramatically. And what better way to send a message to people? Try it, because it doesn't work and it ain't going to change. And this is what will happen to you.
Yeah, and we certainly have noticed that, it's one of our golden rules, really, that things have to be managed peacefully. So I suppose it makes a lot of sense to realise that if anybody's not recommending doing it peacefully, they should be treated with a degree of suspicion.
Well, precisely. And, the thing about doing things peacefully, doing things properly, I think it's a phrase I might have used before, we need to be employing the Kalashnikov of the 21st century, and that is the video camera. We need documentary evidence. Video and good quality audio is invaluable. More people are learning how to use this. We're teaching people how to use it. We're encouraging people how to use it. And it is one of the best instruments you can get. You know, let's use the instruments they have. Let's use them against them. Let's use the fact that they've stuck bloody CCTV cameras up in every high street. Well, let's get there. You know, if you're going to get stopped by the police and there isn't a CCTV camera, you know, just make that little bit of extra journey if you can and pull over where there is a CCTV camera. Start putting what they call dog cams, road hawks, so on and so forth. Get these in your car. I've got them in every car that I've got. They're invaluable.
Yeah. I think there seems to be a bit of a feeling in the chat box that nowadays people have realised that promoting violence isn't going to work, so that some of the infiltrators are certainly learning to do other things. So
yeah, precisely. But you know what? One of the things that can work, and sometimes I do... You know, I'm a bit off par tonight, as you know, and anyone that's actually seen me talking live or doing a training thing, you know, I'm usually quite lively and very, a little bit emotional, a bit excitable. But what we have to start doing is, let's take, for instance, social services. I'm dealing with, I think it's either 9 or 11 ongoing investigations with social services and the way that they're kidnapping our youth. Well, these people along the lines, they're committing offences. Individuals are committing offences.
Yeah.
So let's not let them hide behind the establishment. And that goes for the police force and it goes for any other agency. Let's pursue them individually. You know, again, I can't give specifics, but, you know, we've got one particular case where one social worker's actions amount to Section 2 harassment. Now, Section 2 harassment, or things that, a course of conduct that may constitute harassment, can be overlooked if it is for the welfare of a child. So basically they're saying, well, we can negate this if it is ultimately for the welfare of a child. But even when they've gone beyond that threshold and they're doing it and you've got documentary evidence of it, which we have because there's covert cameras and there's covert recording equipment in the house, then let's say, actually, we're coming after you.
Yeah.
We're not going after social services. We're coming after you. You are the one we're going to be bringing criminal charges against. You are the one that's going to be held accountable. You are the one that potentially is going to lose your job and your liberty, so on and so forth.
Because they are individually responsible for their actions, aren't they? Corporate shield. Sorry. Yeah, let's make
them accountable for their actions. Let's stop messing about with rallying against agencies and policies and so on. Let's start making them as individuals feel vulnerable of the very laws. That, you know, this is another thing I hear a lot of people say, oh, well, their laws, their list. Actually, they're not their laws. They're our laws.
Yeah.
You know, let's face it. They're there. They're existing. They exist. And they're in everyday use in the courts. We're not in a position to change that. So let's use it. They are our laws. Let's start using them. Let's start evidencing things properly. Let's bring these people to task, because the more and more people that are brought to task, the more the people that suffer some sort of punishment for what they've done, the more it's going to make other people within the groups have to say, well, hang on a minute, we're going to have to sort of really sort ourselves out. We're going to have to start doing these things properly, or we could become victims of that. You know, you get a family judge that makes a decision that affects, the future of a child. Now, beyond the immediate family and their circle of friends and maybe a little bit of news coverage on it, a little bit of stuff going on the internet, it doesn't get any further than that. But you know what, when it will make headlines is when that person is suddenly held accountable. It'll make headlines when the actions of that person, through multi-level partnership sharing and so on and so forth, that information is broadcast, not to a few hundred people, but to several thousands of people, tens of thousands of people.
Which is that's one of the core aims of your community press group, isn't it?
Well, that's absolutely. But let's not do anything that we shouldn't be doing. Let's stop saying they're their laws. Let's accept that they're also accountable by those laws, and let's start making them accountable, because we will get convictions.
Yeah.
And once you start to get convictions, the ripples will start to develop into a tsunami.
Yeah. And is it helpful to be taking contemporaneous notes under these circumstances?
Contemporaneous notes are quite a difficult thing to do because, you and I have had a conversation now. If somebody said to you, right, well, you know, just what did Dave Eden say in the last 30 seconds, you probably couldn't write it down. You certainly couldn't write it down at the rate that I'm talking. What I would advocate, and again, without going into details, all I can say is we've got a very, very, very good case going on at the moment. We can't publicise it. But when we do publicise it, it really is going to put the fear of God up to some police officers.
So have you found some of this stuff making itself into the mainstream as a result of what you're doing?
No, not yet, because as I said, it's quite a long and atrocious journey to get there, to get the convictions. But I mean, on this particular case that I'm talking about, I won't give specifics, but I'll give an overview. A gentleman was stopped by a police officer against whom he'd previously made a complaint that was upheld. He's alighted from his vehicle. He's got in his hand a digital video recorder and, his vehicle camera, which he also records audio as well. Can't go into too many specifics, but he subsequently gets arrested for assaulting police, something that he did not do, and it's evidence that he didn't do it. The officer that had his recorder that he confiscated and put in his pocket didn't hand it in at the property. There's evidence from the CCTV that was obtained in the custody suite that the guy said, look, that policeman's got this in his pocket, and they wouldn't do it. That's now, that's mysteriously appeared a month later, minus all the content that was on it. But the fact is, there is sufficient evidence there now to prove criminal offences against these people.
And that's fundamentally because the technology is as good as your contemporaneous notes, but it keeps
track. It's better.
It's better because it keeps track with it in real time, yeah?
Yeah, and this is what people need. You know, this is one of the skills. This is what we're teaching people to do, and teaching people how to write evidence, what the points to prove are, and how to do it properly, how to write it on what they call an MG11, which is a Criminal Justice Act Section 9 statement, how to write an MG11, how to write it on that. I mean, we give out generic MG11 forms, and I, in the time of being, I'm going to actually start sticking them onto the website so people can download them for themselves. And so this is, and then from that process, we teach people, this is what you need to do. These are the forms that you need to submit to get disclosure. You're entitled to disclosure after you've been charged. These are the things that you should be asking for. This is what they have to give you in terms of disclosure. Then actually, as well as all that, let's throw an SAR, a subject access request, into the pot as well.
Yeah,
you would be amazed what comes out from there.
Can you remind people what a subject access request is for people who haven't come across it?
Yeah, that you can stick that into any authority. You can ask for all information that they've got on you, even to the contents, any emails that have been sent that include your name, so on and so forth. Now, a specimen subject access request will be written and put up onto the site as well for people to look at. It costs you £10. They've got 40 days to supply that information, and when they've got 40 days, that is a maximum. That doesn't mean to say they can take 40 days. Yeah. They have to do it as soon as practicable.
Yeah.
But you would be amazed at some of the things that they do disclose, because these things go to different people, especially the police forces. They go to civilian members of staff who just think, all right, oh, yeah, that's that, and I'll just send it out. And, so much of the time it comes back unsanitized. But this is, and this isn't to say, look, we're after you, we're coming after you, we're going to do this. No, we're not going to do that. All we're asking you to do is to do your job and to do it properly and fairly and correctly. But we have the right to evidence that you're doing it. Your vision statement says we are transparent, we are accountable. Well, yeah, you are, because we're going to make sure that you are.
And how do people get themselves onto one of these training courses?
I mean, they can write to us. I think at the moment we've trained in excess of 60 CPOs. I think we've got circa 400 on the list. They're going to be held all over the country. It's a 2-day training course. There's quite a lot of input from me, from several other people. We have people that will talk to you about writing specifically for the internet, so on and so forth. you know, they're quite comprehensive. We've had an awful lot of good feedback, and as a result of which, you know, we then look at people can join the NAPJ, which is National Association of Public Journalists, which we've registered as a not-for-profit limited company. And this is the idea, to get this unity. We're not going to go to ACPO. ACPO are a private company. We're not going to say to them, can you give us permission to be journalists? Well, they've got to screw themselves, quite frankly.
You were saying in your presentation that that it's ACPO that are responsible for recognising journalists, which came as a surprise to me.
Yeah, they're the people that they issue the thing. And they, you know, they will say to the police forces, right, the NUJ is recognised as, you know, an official union of journalists. Well, we don't need that. We are journalists. We're journalists by virtue of the fact that we write something down. We are journalists. We have the right to free speech. We have the right to recognition as journalists. And this is what the National Association of Journalists will do. The NAPJ, National Association of Public Journalists. And so we give the, you know, we dish out the cards. As I said, it's a proper registered limited not-for-profit company. We will then source, we're in the process now sorting various insurances, so people, you know, they've got insurances if somebody wants to sue them because they think that they've been libeled. We're going to look there for people so they can get insurance for proper, not state-funded representation if they're arrested for any reasons. And which is going to grow it and grow it and grow it and grow it, and we're going to make it a force to be reckoned with.
So it's once again, the might is right. What we need is numbers there, isn't it?
That's what you need with everything. And the other thing as well, what I do not like, now, you know, I came down and I spoke at the festival. We all know what a diverse group of people are going to be at a festival. The training day at Glastonbury was a very, very different and far more diverse group of people the people that were trained in Hertfordshire. Now, again, I'm not going to mention any names, but I did have somebody that is very, very well known say to me, well, you know, that person's not suitable to be a journalist, that person's, well, why not? Well, they've got a tattoo on their neck and they're this and they're that. Really? So we're actually making judgments now who's suitable to be a journalist, are we? Well, I don't think we do that, because there isn't a single person in this country that is not suitable to be a journalist. There isn't one single person who doesn't have an opinion that counts for something. You know, our youngest person is 18. Our eldest CPO is 71. We have people in the research departments that are unfortunately subject to being disabled. And so, you know, what they're doing is they're working and researching from home.
Yeah.
But they feel part of something, they're contributing, and that's what it's about. And I'm quite certain Neil's got more to add to that.
Yeah, go for it, Neil. What have you got to say, mate?
Yeah, I was talking to Alan Taylor Shearer for a couple of hours there just before I came on air here on my own radio show. And we were talking about this issue of, you know, who is a journalist, who isn't a journalist. Now, there's a bill going through Parliament at the moment. It's known as the gagging bill. It's got a very lengthy title. I can't remember it. It tripped off Alan's tongue, no problem, but I can't remember it. But basically, it's stating that a year before an election, that basically nobody who is not an accredited journalist is allowed to report on any aspect of government policy, and they're not even allowed to have an opinion on any aspect of government policy whatsoever. And I think, going back to what Dave says there, this comes down to numbers. They're basically saying that only authorised journalists can report anything. Anybody else is who's not authorised can't even have an opinion, as I say, on anything to do with government policy 1 year before an election. So I think Dave's absolutely spot on. We need basically thousands of NAPJ journalists so they can't shut us down, because they will try. They will try.
And of course, all of us who are hosting shows on any of these internet radio stations are, in fact, radio journalists, aren't we? So they're perhaps trying to gag us there.
Well, that's included in it. We won't be allowed to talk about it either. Not even to give an opinion, because you're not allowed to give an opinion one way or another, yes or no, on any subject to do with government policy a year before an election.
Is this part that you're seen as being a lobbyist, Neil?
Yes.
Yeah, and are we right in assuming that because of the knowledge that Dave's talking about here, that we can hope for some sort of protection from such draconian laws through the community press group?
Well, yeah
we will do that. We will achieve that. We'll do it through numbers.
Numbers, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll make them recognise us. There'll be no alternative other than to recognise us as accredited journalists. And, you know, where do we stop there? What, you know, what are bloggers? Are they journalists? You know, isn't everybody a journalist of some sort? You know, the other thing, briefly going back to what I was saying about, you know, recording things and that sort of stuff. I've just inquired today about having some, I think they're called, they're like a sticky plastic, but you know the sort of things that hold your car, your tax disc on your car.
Yeah.
And it's basically, it's going to have the Community Press logo on there. And it's just going to say, you know, like the occupants of this residence are affiliated to the Community Press Group. By entering the premises or the grounds of the premises, you will be filmed, you will be audio recorded, and you may be subject to public broadcast. Any film or audio recordings can be used in evidence, we will use them in evidence in criminal or civil proceedings against you. And exactly the same little smaller versions of the stickers for people to stick in their cars. Because, you know, it's a very powerful statement, especially when they see the word press. They'll back away from it.
Yeah,
because we're telling them straight away, here, we're going to film you, mate.
Yeah, you were saying that the rank and file tend to respond fairly strongly to a press card.
Well, they do, and I mean, you know, that was one of the whole purpose about the Community Press Group. The reason that I looked at it, you know, it wasn't a case of we sat down and we thought, oh, what should we call it? You know, we'll do it this, and it's a very flippant sort of a process. You know, it was a very determined process. Oxfordshire alone has 60 different community outreach programs. Now, these are sponsored by partnership organizations. So you may have the police, the social service, the educational service, so on and so forth, all sponsoring to a degree these outreach programs. Now, in my opinion, this is just another disingenuous way of paying lip service to something they really don't care about. Why have we got police community PCSOs, police community support officers? Why aren't they just police support officers? And I'll tell you why, because community is a very powerful thing. And the Community Press Group, we are a community, and we're working on behalf of the community. How can that be a good thing? How can that be something that's, you know, that you should challenge? The rank and file will step away. They will take that step back. It will make them think, whoa, hang on a minute, press, what are these people going to do? What is going to be reported?
It certainly sounds like a pretty useful sticker to have in the front of your motor.
Well, this is what we're going to do, and people can put them on their doors, on the windows of their houses. We're giving them fair notice, and there's also going to be a little bit on the bottom there, the statement from the Metropolitan Police, you know, saying that you can, it's quite lawful and you cannot be prevented filming police officers exercising their duty and or dealing with incidences. Because they will try and stop you, they will put their hand out, they will try and take the camera off you. Well, at that point, you're committing an offence.
Yeah.
So let's start that. They're using this technology against us. Every time you step out of your door, you acquiesce to the fact that they are going to record you by some methodology. And they say, you know that they're in the high street, you know they're in the supermarket, you know they're in the shopping centre, you choose to go there, you're acquiescing to the fact that you could be recorded. Well, it works the same way around. They've got cameras in the police cars, so we've got cameras in our cars.
And what we're suggesting here really is effectively that to a certain extent officialdom at least appears to be paying lip service to community support, whereas what we're after is providing genuine community support.
Well, that is the whole idea behind the thing. And, you know, as we grow in momentum, as we grow in stature, certainly in financial stability, you know, there are going to be certain running costs. You've got to be able to run an office. You've got to be able to, you know, I personally won't take a salary because I've got a pension. But, you know, people at some point are going to have their expenses covered. But what we're hoping to do is that we're going to generate significant and sufficient funds, really with the sole aim of sponsoring community projects. That's what we need to do. We need to be putting this back out into the community. You know, they're giving 60 outreach programs, but at the same time, they're closing down the local community centre and the library. Well, let's stop that. Let's reopen them. Let's do that. Somebody comes along and says, you know, we've got an idea. We can host, you know, an activity day for disabled adults every Wednesday from 10 till 6 at the community centre. It's going to cost this amount of money. We need a table tennis table. We need a dartboard, so on and so forth. Let's see if we can fund that. Let's see if we can fund the first year's rent of what they're going to do. But at the same time, teach them how to raise funds. Put this effort back into the community. We've got people like, you know, not just myself, but lots of people. Believe me, I'm not the only police officer or ex-police officer that's in this. There are a lot more. They've got specialist knowledge. We've got people that have got areas of specialist knowledge. Well, somebody might come and say, I need help with this, which is going to require input that you know, is can only be got through specialist knowledge. Right, that's fine. Let's do that. However, this is going to take us 2 days to work on this particular thing. You're a builder. Mrs. Patel's had her wall back knocked down. Let's have an exchange of equity. You go back into the community. You build her wall while we do what we do for you. And that can work in every city, every county, every city, every village. And that is the idea of doing it, because it breaks down barriers. It's said it knocks this S off of the word communities.
I think that's a really great idea, and it gives everybody, even if they haven't got the gaming tokens, they can have equity within this system. Neil's got a point he wants to make on libraries, I think. Have you, Neil?
Yeah, I discussed this there before, and something that myself and a few colleagues had thought about a number of years ago when they're closing down libraries. You know, wouldn't it be great to have a library of our own? You know, and there's so many of these small libraries in particular being shut down in villages or, you know, small towns and stuff. And, you know, if the community press group can help to keep one of these open for a year until they get on their feet and they can support themselves, what a great opportunity to put the proper books on the shelves for people to read and put a big notice on it saying, these are the books that weren't in the library before.
I think that's a great point, because I'm aware from some of my reading that libraries are being closed at ever increasing rates, and it is the modern day equivalent of burning books.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got a thing called Kindle. What is kindling? You know, it's burning books, isn't it?
Good point.
You know, and also we have Tesco book banks. Now, I've often thought, again, I mean, you'd get arrested for it, but you know, somebody wants to go there and get a pile of books and put a match to them and say, do you think this is any different? Because those books aren't going to libraries or care homes for people to reuse again. They've been put in an incinerator.
Yeah.
So we're at that point already where they're burning books. You know, they don't want people going to libraries and actually reading books and requesting books, because you can go into a library and request any book from anywhere in the world. And if they can get it, they'll get it for you. Or they used to do that for you. But you can go on Amazon and pick or any other search engine and find a book that you really want to read, which isn't standard, a standard publication for a library, and they will get it for you. And they do not want that. They do not want you reading those kind of books. It's as simple as that.
It's still the way it works around here in Mid Wales, where I'm hanging out. The library service is absolutely invaluable. There's not a single thing we've requested of them that they haven't come up with. And this sounds like a great idea to me, because I've been saying for some time that rather than fight against the kind of taking apart of the system, what we need to be doing is providing realistic replacement services, you know, that actually work. And
that's the thing, isn't it? You take it down, we'll rebuild it.
Yeah, yeah.
At that point, the community actually sees that people within their own community are actually doing something, and they don't have to rely on government services to provide them with their needs. They can do it themselves. And they don't need the government for this.
Quite so. And people, it seems to me, really do want to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that's stopping people working together is government policy, dividing everybody.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
And so
as Dave says, they've created communities rather than a community.
Yes.
That's what they've done to divide everybody. There's that community, this community, that community, and we're all separate. You know, let's not get together and sort the problems of the world out. Let's keep everybody divided and arguing amongst themselves, because it distracts from what's really happening. Simple as that. It's a technique they've used for thousands of years. It's nothing new.
So as well as offering sort of training to us as public journalists, you're also starting to look at the idea of helping people to administer and support the things that they need. And what you were saying, Dave, I gather, is that that you'd be endeavouring to support things for the first year, and provide training in administration and in raising funds, presumably, to make the thing self-sustaining within the community. Is that right?
That's what we need. Absolutely, 100%. And if you, you know, you've got, because that expertise is out there in the community. It's out there in every community. You know, sometimes it just needs the impetus to get it off the ground. And that's it. Yeah, we might be able to do this for a year. We might be able to do it for 6 months. Here are the people that are going to give you advice. This is how you're going to fundraise. And the fact that they're doing it in the community, for the community, with the community, and the community itself is building back something that it needs, it will start to work. It's, you know, what they say, every journey starts with one step. Let's do it. Let's stop talking about it and let's do it. This is the most frustrating thing in the world to me. I'm absolutely, totally at my wit's end listening to people talk about it.
Yeah,
we just have to do it, and we can do it. All it takes is will.
And as you were saying, I think you were saying in your presentation that you'd come across people saying to primary school kids, every time a child is born, the earth groans.
Yeah, I mean, that is part of UN Agenda 21, and that is one of the things that was in some of the literature there, and, you know, they were being taught, and, you know, that's it, you know, let's colour these pictures in, and this is the earth, and this is the earth groaning because another child has been born, and, you know, that is an actual statement from one of those books. Yeah, you're quite right, every time the another child is born, the earth groans. Why are we teaching children this at this age? You know, what is the purpose of school? Sorry, Neil.
It's to give them a guilt complex so they don't have children themselves.
Yeah.
That's what it's for.
Yeah.
What we're hoping to do is restore the value to children because they are, of course, the hope of the future.
Yeah.
Sorry, Neil, you go ahead and I'll talk.
I just said the children are the only hope for the future. They are the future. You know, so that's why they're trying to instill these ideas in them, not to have children. Simple. It's simple. You know, it's psychology.
Yeah, why are these other agencies in the schools? Why are the police community officers getting involved in schools programs? You know, what are they teaching the kids? What, you know, he's going to get to a stage now where the, you know, little Johnny's a bit different from the other children. So let's tell the PCSO, you know, mummy and daddy drove to the chip shop last night. They didn't walk. Oh, that's naughty. Let's tell the PCSO. You know, I might be stretching the point here, and it might not be happening today. I don't know, but it's certainly bloody coming.
I remember it being very much a point in 1984 that children were being encouraged to report on their parents, as it were.
Yes. Well, it's coming. Getting back to what we were saying very quickly about the CCTVs and the cameras and everything being everywhere, just out of an interest, the ANPR system, the automatic number plate system, if you've got a car, you know, in my days when I had a car equipped with that, I could stop you, I could talk to you, I could ask where you've been, so on and so forth, and I could run a thing called a TE, a transaction inquiry, on the computer from my car, which would tell me every camera your car had ever driven through, certainly for the last 2 years. The records go back further than that, and I could get those records. I just needed to get another level of authorization. It is a fact now that the ANPR databases hold on record over 15 billion. Now, that's right, billion. 15 billion journeys.
Wow. This is a
point. So what's that about?
This is a point that I was trying to make to some friends of mine when I was last in Spain, because they seem to think that that you still need to have some kind of license to tap somebody's phone. But I was saying, well, look, it's all on the record. All they need is to arrest you for whatever reason, and then they can look at all this stuff, where your car's been, who you've been visiting, who you've phoned, who's on your contact list, because it's all on the digital record. There is no need to tap anybody's individual phones anymore.
Well, no, but, I mean, you know, what we should be doing now, we should all be doing it, we should all be having a lock code on our phone. Because once that phone gets into the custody suite, what they'll do is, you know, they'll take it off you and your property. They will ask you to unlock it, or if it's not locked, they will go into it. And what they're doing, what they're saying they're doing, is they're searching for the IMEI number, whatever it's called, to make sure they can check it against the base that the handset isn't stolen. But that doesn't actually stop the unlawful downloading of the information or reading through the information or text messages. If your phone is locked, you can just say to them, turn my phone off, please. Yeah. What's your code? I'm not telling you. You're not an, they have no power to do that. They have no power to look at your phone. So why give them the opportunity to do that? Don't do it.
That's another good piece of advice. I haven't got one on mine. I'll make sure I put one on. So is it, do you reckon, I mean, as we've said, we are effectively a single community. We're facing the same stuff here. Is it your impression that all policemen are happy to be doing what they're doing, or have we got a lot of them who are a bit angry about being told what they can and can't look at and how to do stuff?
I'll tell you now, they're a lot more angry about what they're not told. They're told that they can't do, or that the way that the police force is being managed. They're a lot more angry than are happy with it. I still speak regularly to large numbers of police officers. I'm not saying anything that the authorities probably don't already know. The amount of information that is given to me, whether it's directly or whether it's through slightly other circular routes, and so I know the levels of dissatisfaction in the service. And fundamentally, what we have to do, as I said before, a lot of police officers, the rank and file officers, they're powerless. You've got ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers Limited, who are supposed to be there for them, who are actually working against them. The Police Federation is a particularly toothless tiger. So how do they do something as an individual? And this is the very, very reason that we've started to look at TETRA. These police officers have been irradiated by low-level microwave radiation. The sets that they're walking around with are slowly killing them. You've got officers with brain tumours, esophageal cancers, breakdown in the blood-brain barrier, allowing neurotoxins into the brain, and so on and so forth. Now, we could argue all these on an individual point and say, well, this is this, this and this. But let's look at what the very, very first thing about what these radios are. There's enough research out there to say that TETRA has been looked at. It was looked at for the development as a weapon. The side effects of it and the medical consequences are well known, but it was still introduced as a radio system. In layman's terms, exposure to the TETRA microwave radiation in units, in Canada I think it's 6, in America and Russia it's 10. Actually, none of those countries are using TETRA for radios. At the UK levels are 3,300. What we have to concentrate on there is the fact that this was brought in. Jan Berry, I believe it was, stated that nothing was going to stop this trial. That's a very important word. The word trial is very, very important, because that is an indication that they're potentially doing something that is unlawful. They signed into law regulations and laws that prohibited the experimentation on humans. And that is fundamentally what they're doing. We're now seeing police forces, Hertfordshire police forces, have started to introduce TETRA medicals. TETRA medicals, yes, because they've been using the radio system now for 10 years. What are the effects on the officers? How many of them have got cancers? How many of them have got these problems? Let's find out. Well, it's unlawful. So let's concentrate on that one aspect. Let's push that agenda. Let's start organising a national conference. Let's, get the experts out there. Let's get people from academia onto the stage to talk about this and to challenge it. Because it's that action, and that action alone by people outside of the police force, the ambulance service, fire service, SE rescue, even the mountain rescue people are all using this technology. But what does that say? It says, we are concerned. We don't want you to be irradiated. We don't want you dying of cancers. You can't fight this battle. The Police Federation is certainly not fighting this battle. So we'll fight this battle on your behalf.
Yeah, you brought up an interesting point again in your presentation about just exactly how powerful this is. I think you gave an example of what it's being used for in war zones by the Americans, although they're not using it domestically. They are using it when they're in combat, aren't they?
You know, I think I'm going to have to really clarify that point, because I can't definitively say it. I never want them to quote the works of somebody else as if it's knowledge that is, you know, that I've, that I know, because, you know, I've done this. But fundamentally, there is a system that is known as Commander Solo, which is very similar technology. It's sort of microwave radiation upon which they tetradyne additional information, generally radio, sound waves, things of that nature. I think, if I remember rightly, it works at about 0.3 megahertz up to 3 megahertz. But Tetra was originally developed as a weapon. I mean, the research into Tetra went on from the, I think it was about 1970, 72 up to the early 1980s. And it was looked at by the British and the Americans as a weapon. You know, and they can weaponize it, and they are weaponizing it, and I believe they have weaponized it. One of the conclusions of that particular study, and this is quite interesting because I know this exists because I've actually seen the documentation, in the long list of conclusions that came to it, you know, that there was concerns expressed that, you know, if the in excess of 4,000 side effects or conditions that could be generated by the use of Tetra were to become known or were to be taken into serious consideration, that it would have an enormous impact on its commercial value. And yeah, we've now sold it to 150 countries.
And that's another good reason for doing the public journalism thing, isn't it, really? Is to bring it to people's attention, because certainly we have on occasions been asking policemen and women, when they've been asking us questions, we've asked them how they feel about it, and it seems to come as quite a surprise to a lot of them.
Oh, I've dealt with police people that said to me, oh, we don't use Tetra, we use airwaves. Yeah, all right, mate. Yeah, airwaves. Yeah, I don't eat chocolate, I eat Mars bars, all right, whatever. You know, just, and so many of them are very dismissive of it. Suddenly they start to pay a little bit more attention. When you start telling them, you do realise that emits it all the time. You know, you get into a car and there's two radios and a radio in the car, you've immediately gone above your daily safe levels, you know, above safety recommendations, and that's at 3,300 units. However, you take that unit home, don't you? Because they take them home. And where do you charge it? You charge that around your children and your wife.
Mm.
Now start to think about it. Because when your child starts to have, you know, and again, I'm not going to say this as if I, you know, I definitively know it to be fact, based on the works of Barry Trower, who I think is probably one of the leading experts in Tetra. You know, what Barry is saying, this is going to cause those children, you know, the female children, it damages certain aspects of their reproduction system. And these, you know, these children are then going to be giving birth to children, or their children are going to be giving birth to children that are showing symptoms as far reaching as being those displayed by thalidomide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now think about it. Now think about what you're doing. Because you're not talking about you and your blasé macho, oh, you know, I'm a cop, so what, you know, oh, this could kill me, that could kill me. Because what is this doing to your kids?
Yeah, because they're a lot more susceptible to these kind of these radiations, aren't they, than grown adults. They haven't got a properly developed brain-blood barrier and all of that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like a lot of other things. A lot of things come back down to basics, don't they? You've just got to ask basic question. And there's one basic question that can be asked about Tetra. You know, you can push everything else aside. And as Barry says, there is one question that I want you, the government experts and scientists, to answer for me. What is the safe level of exposure to Tetra microwave radiation in the first 100 days of pregnancy? And they won't tell them. Why won't they tell them? Because there is no safe level. Are they going to admit that? No. So, it's like so many things. We can argue about this aspect of that aspect of other thing. But in that one question alone and their refusal to answer, it tells us everything we need to know, doesn't it?
It does indeed, as does, I think, the fact that the Canadians and the Americans are refusing to use it at any level at all. I think Neil's got a point he wants to make there, have you, Neil?
Now, we'll get back to the reproductive organs of females. I think it's actually the, because the females are born with all their eggs for future reproduction, I think it's the eggs that get affected in young children more than anything else. And it affects the DNA, and that's how the defects come about later on. And the other point was that tetra also has the capacity to change behaviour in terms of it can make people more susceptible to acting aggressively, passively, the opposite effect. It can also make them have suicidal feelings and things like that.
Yeah.
So when we see police officers acting totally bizarrely and aggressively, then, you know, that's something to consider, because it's not a normal human reaction when you see a police officer just wading into a crowd and beating up people with a baton. That's not normal behaviour for anybody. You know, no. So what's been done to that guy? You know, what's been done to these people? They're victims. They have to be looked at as victims. This kind of technology has been used against them.
Yes, indeed. I have heard that, in fact, ideas can more or less be projected into minds using this technology. I don't know whether you've heard that.
That is the same that we were just talking about, the the Commander Solo using this technology and using the transmitting a microwave beam, then tetradyning it with a sound bite or an audio wave. And I think one of the examples that's using that, you know, you see 600 Iraqi soldiers surrendering to 3 or 4 American soldiers that stood there with their M16s. I think they were the words of Richard Allen Miller, who was one of the people that worked on this technology.
Yeah. Yeah, thoroughly, thoroughly wicked piece to tackle by all accounts. Can we spend a bit of time on, because what I know, one of the things that I really didn't look at for a while was these rumours that so many children are effectively being kidnapped by the state. I've recently realised that even official figures for the UK seems to be admitting that something like 100,000 a year might be going missing, and we know for sure that it's being done effectively with secret courts and kind of no witnesses, so that it appears to me that, you know, most of the population are completely unaware of this. Is there any hope, do you reckon, that we can start doing something about this? Because it seems to be in primary need of attention to me.
Neil, do you want to start on that one?
Well, it's obvious that that's taking place. And I was just talking to the same thing to Alan Tillisier earlier on today. That there's a lot of money in children, for a start. I mean, apart from the more, how should we call it, evil aspect of child kidnapping, which is obviously for use in paedophile rings and other such things, even more ghastly than paedophilia, believe it or not. And there's a lot of money in children, in the adoption business, as it's become. And the government is now actively promoting adoption agencies in the private sector to take on the so-called burden of all these children they've kidnapped. And that's the words. They have kidnapped them. And they're basically being sold to the highest bidder through catalogues. You know, and as for security checks or, you know, checks on who's getting these children, I don't think they're anywhere near sufficient. And the so-called reputable organisations such as Barnardo's, it's alleged, make about £100,000 per child if they get them out adopted.
Good Lord.
So, there's one reason. Yeah. There's one reason.
Neil, can I jump in on that as well. We're currently looking at about 11 cases of this. It's so difficult because you so desperately want to share this information, but you can't because it's potentially sub judice. I mean, one case, in fact, we're bringing 9 separate people together to bring a class action. So we're hoping that's going to have some impact. One of the things that we found out recently, I can't mention the area where, but there is a particular social worker that's in the employ of the social services who has got 3 properties out of the area that they're in. There are 5 properties that act as halfway homes for foster children. This particular social worker just happens to own 3 of these homes. Now, each child that's in there is £400 a week. I think there's five children per home. So that's 2,000 a week, 8,000 a month times three. So you've got £24,000 a month income from that. Now, when this is brought up and it's suggested to the powers that be, well, hang on a minute, isn't this a conflict of interest? You know, how can somebody that's involved in the process and responsible for taking children away from their parents and putting them into the foster care program and then potentially up for adoption, so on and so forth, how can this person be profiteering from this and actually own three of the premises where the children may go to? Well, the answer to that is no, it's not a conflict of interest because that person doesn't know which of the five homes that child that she recommends for, or she's part of the recommendation for the cost of the foster care process will go to, you know. And who's making money out of this? You know, it's not just the social workers. You've got to look at psychiatrists. I mean, you know, what have we got now? We've got psychiatry and Big Pharma being used as another social control. They're getting involved with the children. You know, making tens, potentially hundreds of thousands in fees from the public purse. It's big money.
Neil's mentioning something called GERFAC, whatever that is. Well, if you want to come in on that, Neil, and then perhaps we can address whether we've got any solutions to this, because every time I hear about it, it just gets bigger and bigger and more organised. So what's GERFAC then, Neil?
Well, this comes straight out of the UN, but they're using Scotland as a trial balloon for it. But I've seen things in the media down in England where they're saying, oh, the social worker missed this, they missed it. How did we miss this? We need to do something about it. So this is a UN program that's going to be rolled out worldwide. I think they've already started it in America as well. And the acronym in Scotland is GERFEC, which is Getting It Right for Every Child, where every child born in Scotland now is assigned a social worker who is a designated person. I don't know if Dave's explained what a designated person is. You can't really interfere with them at all in any way. They have access to that child 24 hours a day. They can come into your home whenever they want. They can go into the child's school whenever they want. They can detain that child without your consent or the child's and do with that child what they want. And this is the way it's going to go. This is the state actually coming right into your house and interfering with your children. And they've made this a legitimate pursuit for anybody who's got a career mind of that kind of idiocy, shall I say, to do such a job. But this is what they're trying to bring in. This is what's in Scotland already. And if you think the family courts are bad, well, this is way beyond that. This is just people being allowed to come in your home and take your child at any time of the day they want.
And this is...
You've no legal recourse to stop it.
And this is every child, presumably, as soon as it's... Every child born.
Every child born. It's going to be assigned a social worker. It's happening now. It's actually in place now.
Right.
So how many social workers are we going to need for a start? I thought we were poor. I thought we had no money.
Yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah.
But they've got plenty of money for this to interfere with your family life. And they come in and check that you're putting your child to bed at night, the proper time. You're feeding them the proper genetically modified food, I suppose. And they've been vaccinated up to date. All this stuff.
Mm.
And they've got authority to take that child at any time they want.
And what sort of defence do we have against this then, Dave?
Well, I mean, this is a difficult
no.
one. You're quite right. Just say no. But we know that, I mean, I've got some footage that's come to me this week. It's not going to be broadcast yet. It can't be broadcast yet because of what potentially is going to happen with it. But you've got a child that's been taken from a mother. The child is about 5 hours old. And I kid you not, there are, in view of the camera, in excess of 20 police officers, and I'm reliably told that there was another 10 or 12 in a van round the corner. And this is including two police horses, an ambulance, and everybody else to take a child off the lady that had been given birth. An independent social worker and midwife at the scene said there was no issue, so on and so forth, but they came in and took the child anyway. We've got to stop fighting what the criteria for this is.
Hang on a moment, Dave. I think it's breaking up again at the moment. I'm going to put another tune on just quickly because last time that gave us a chance to clear it up. So hold on a moment. We'll just whip back to the broadcaster, bang a tune on. Sorry about this, folks. It did work last time. We'll just play a quick couple of minutes of music and then we'll be back with the guests. I don't want you to miss anything that's going on here, so... Okay, you are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. We've got Dave Eden and Neil Foster from the Community Press Group on the line dealing with a load of stuff. I noticed, Dave, in the chat box whilst we were listening to that, that we've discovered, it seems, that that registration of your actual child is one of the things that maybe invites these people to come and take them off you. Have you got any comment to make about that?
I certainly have. The child that was witnessed being taken the other day hadn't been registered. This was put across to the police officers. Sergeant stared back at them incredulously, and it made not the slightest bit of difference whatsoever. And unfortunately, you know, it's very good to think that something's going to do something in theory. Proof of the pudding is in the eating. I do get quite frustrated because people sort of tell me of these things and this has happened, that happened. And I said, well, that's great. Now, you know, when did this happen? Well, it happened at such a place. Well, who did it happen to? Well, this bloke that was sat next to somebody on the train knew somebody that did it in Doncaster. Really great. Actually, show me some evidence of that. Show me somebody that I can talk to where this is actually, you know, where it has actually worked. You know, it's not that I don't embrace it. It's not that I don't believe it. But the point is, you know, let's see it actually practically work. And again, it's very subjective, isn't it? Because people want to believe potentially that methodology has worked. You know, they'll say, "Oh yeah, this worked." You know, in likelihood that the child may have been returned anyway, or what happened may have happened, whether it's without this sort of, well, you know, if you can't do this without a birth certificate, you know, getting along the Freeman line of things, you know, you can't do that because I don't consent, so on and so forth. And sometimes, well, somebody had a success there, but actually that could well have been the result anyway. You know, what you need to see now is you need to see a continuity and, you know, in a course of conduct by the authorities or the powers that be that react in a specific way. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing this. And having been part of the system, I know it doesn't happen. You know, there's a little analogy I use when I give my, give the presentations. And it's very, very simple, and he sort of puts it. There's an old program called Step to Unsun, and in one episode, I think it was Divided We Stand or something, they split the house in half and they have a television. And Harold wants to watch a ballet and Albert doesn't. And as Harold says, you know, well, you know, Mondays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, you know, I get to choose the program. I've got the law of contract on my side, to which Albert rightly says, well, I've got the buttons on my side. And this is the problem. A lot of the time, they've got the buttons on their side. So I
guess ultimately we're back to what we were talking about earlier on, aren't we? And that is the fact that people don't know that this is going on, and that by getting our own journalists working, by spreading whatever news happens amongst hundreds or thousands of people, awareness has got to be our best instrument here, perhaps.
It has got to be our best instrument. It's a show of force. It's a show of force. I hate that word. I shouldn't say it. It's a display of consolidation. You know, we're here together and we're going to do this together. We've got about 9 or 11 of these investigations currently going on into what is quite frankly, just either malpractice or criminality by certain members of the social services that are involved in these activities. And, you know, how do we go with it? We start making people accountable again.
Yeah.
And that, you know, individually accountable. We've got to publicise as many as we can. One of the things that does concern me is people jump on a bandwagon and they start advertising. They start promoting incidences and this has happened and this was done and this child was stolen or so on and so forth. And there's all sorts of allegations of, there's paedophilia in this and there's so on and so forth. And for one second, I'm not saying that that's not the case. But like anything else, we were saying about disruptors being in a, you know, or fake activists. Well, let's bear in mind there are people out there that are doing exactly the same thing. And then when you start looking at the cases, I'm looking at one case, you know, particularly now, there's a lot of people banging on about it on the internet and various, in various forums. I've obtained all the paperwork on it, which goes back over a number of years. And you know, you've got to be honest to what you see. You've got to be honest to what you know. And actually, if this was ever brought officially into the public domain, they'd shoot it down in flames. And they would quite rightfully shoot it down in flames, because what is being said is clearly and inevitably true. But other people, they just, you know, they hear what they think, that that's what they do, this is what's happening, this is another case of it. But you have to bear in mind that there are going to be these things that are out there and that are promoted through the social medias and through the alternative medias, because they've got there from some other source. And then when it's really subject to scrutiny, it's going to be shot down in flames. And it's just a way of discrediting what's happening genuinely. And for something of this significance, this importance, where people are losing their children to the state and to the system, and potentially into corrupt and immoral environments, we have to be so, so careful that everything that is challenged properly, and that it's challenged and it's done with, you know, with proper evidence. Because yeah. You cannot mess about with this. This is one of the most important aspects of modern society today. We cannot mess around with this. And when these things start to come to prominence on various websites and alternative medias, really what we need to do, we need to be looking at the sourcing of that, and we need to be saying, let's evidence that. And that's what we will do, because by the time that we've gone through what we've done, we've got results, or even if we don't get the result that we want to, we'll have done the system. There's no sensationalism about it. It might have taken us 12 months to go through it. But you know what? Every single bit of evidence will be there to say, this is why it's gone on. This is what's provable. This is how the system has covered it up. This is how the system has lied, cheated, and what have you. And, of course, there might be a price to pay for doing that. Well, let's pay that price.
Yeah.
You know, I'm prepared to pay that price, but let's do it properly.
Yeah, there's Peter O'Kelly's put into the chat box that he said that the system's response, whether it's banks, courts, government, departments, is to flout their own legislation. But I think we need to make the point again, don't we, is that the thing, to a certain extent, it's failures in our response, in our procedures, that are enabling them to do that. Is that the case?
Well, it is. And I mean, let's face it, you know, getting back to what we've got, we've got this sort of belief system, this emotional and intellectual commitment to something. And what we start to do that, we start to use that, and we perceive it as a tool. And sometimes, because we're so emotionally invested in that, we don't realise that this tool isn't working, and it's actually that investment in what we believe to be, and we're not going to move beyond that belief, that stops us making it effective. And sometimes we've got to step outside of that and say, okay, this is what I believe. This might actually be what's right. However, it's not achieving something. So let's look at another methodology that may achieve something. And I know it's hard for people to swallow. Getting back to what people said, I'm not abiding by their rules. They're not their rules. They're my rules. They're your rules. They're all of our laws. They're all of our rules. And you know what? They will remain too, until we can get to the point and say, right, we have now got to that tipping point. There are a significant number of people to take the people that are in positions of authority and that power. We can vote them out of authority. We can vote them out of power. We can say to them, we no longer give you the right to do this. And it's at that point that we can press the reset button.
Yeah.
But if the pill to swallow is to work with the system in order to achieve that, then I'm willing to do it.
Yeah. And again, it is, as you said at the beginning, it is down to the fact that at the moment, all over the country, people can be effectively trying the same thing, which has already been found in one place not to work. Other people might have found things that do work to a certain extent, and that doesn't get shared either. So again, this coming together, sharing knowledge is one of the most important things. What sort of infrastructure are you getting together to help us share ideas?
Before we answer that question, without any offence to anybody saying this on air, I know, I really, really am not very well at all. As the night's going on, I'm feeling more and more ill. Would it be okay if Neil answers that question and I just politely step aside now and
that's absolutely,
go get some much needed sleep?
That's absolutely great, mate. I really do appreciate the time you've put in here. You've really captured the attention of the chat box. I really appreciate what you're doing. Thanks very much for that. Dave's been pretty sick from the beginning of the show, folks. I think he's putting a great performance for us, brought forward a load of stuff that we really need to know. You can get in touch with him at the community press group, if you need to talk to him more. Thanks a lot, Dave. By all means, go and get yourself some rest. I will do,
thank you. Neil will give all the contacts and emails and so on and so forth. And all I can say is thank you to you. Thank you for listening. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to promote what we're doing. And, you know, all I can say to everybody is please, please, please get involved. Let's do something. Somebody said to me the other day, you're building a militia, aren't you? That's not the case. I'm not building a militia. Nobody's building a militia. There is no hierarchy. What we're trying to do, seriously, is knock the S off the community, the word communities. Let's get on with it. Thanks a lot. Neil, I'll speak to you as and when. I hope that we all speak again very soon.
Brilliant, Dave. Thanks a lot, mate. I'll stay in touch on the email and stuff. And thanks
Please
a lot
do.
For your time. Hope you get
yep.
better.
Good night, all.
Hope you get better soon. Night, Dave. Thanks a lot,
mate.
Yeah,
good night, all. Goodbye.
Cheers a bit.
Excuse me, mate. Right. So we've got this idea of getting people trained to be kind of journalists, to be active spreading ideas. What kind of infrastructure are we getting together, Neil, to enable this to happen, to enable people to find out what works, what doesn't? Cause that's clearly what's going to move us forward most quickly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a great advocate. I believe firmly that, you don't give people advice about taking a certain course of action unless you've actually experienced it yourself or done it yourself, really. And I've done a couple of things that I know work. I mean, simple things. I mean, the TV license and stuff like that. I mean, that's not rocket science, and that can be done easily. I've done it myself. But at the moment, I've dealt with the water company here because they bought over the previous water company. And basically, I went down the route of no contract, blah, 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 and I've never paid it for a year. And they put it to two debt collectors, and the last one's given up, I think. I've never heard of them for 2 months now. So, you know, things like that. I've done it myself. So I'm now nearly a year down the line with this water company. And it's just perhaps worth holding a public meeting in this area where this water company operates and saying, look, lads, you don't have to pay this stuff. Here's how you do it, and take it down that road. But I'm going to put that up on the website eventually, the whole story with all the emails and stuff that I've got. I've got it all documented. But as far as putting ideas forward and what works and what doesn't work, the whole idea of the community press group is that we'll have a community of journalists in every county in the country, and they'll all be able to share their own ideas with each other, and on all different aspects, whether it's the court system, whether it's dealing with the police, whether it's dealing with water companies, whatever, and they can all relate their own experiences and access through the community. Community press group website, which is going to act as a hub for every county in the country who has a group working, and they can share their experiences with another county who's got a similar issue, and they can say what worked there, what didn't work, because as you said earlier, that there's a lot of people doing things which, if they did a bit of research, they would find elsewhere hadn't worked at all in many cases. And so they're actually wasting their own time and effort following a path which inevitably is going to fail. And, there's very little time for us to do things to turn all this around. So if you're going to sit somewhere and waste a lot of time doing something which somebody else knows is not going to work, 100%, then there's no point pursuing that course of action. You're as well, as Dave said, you try a new methodology. It's like a scientist coming up with some kind of hypothesis for, you know, X plus Y equals what, whatever, and it's proven to be wrong. So you have to go back to the hypothesis again and start again. You know, so there's a lot of time invested by people who are simply either, you know, belligerently or ignorantly wasting their time.
Yeah.
On a lot of areas, when they could be far more, you know, productive if they actually, you know, started talking to other people about what methodologies have worked and what hasn't. I mean, we're not here to advise anybody to do this, that, or the next thing. I mean, it's all about sharing experiences and ideas and getting success. There's no point spending weeks or months trying to pursue something which is ultimately going to fail. It's pointless. You know,
yeah.
That's my take on it. But
I think that,
as I say, I think
that's absolutely right. It's a problem that we identified 2-3 years ago, to my knowledge, that we are seeing people fall down the same hole in the ground time and time again. And quite often we're losing some of our best and cleverest people every time that occurs. And of course, if we, it's not only a matter of preventing people, wasting their own effort and the efforts of others. For every one person, every one individual that we can prevent from doing that, we're getting another shoulder to a wheel that might eventually, you know, make progress.
Yeah, I mean, and the other aspect, of course, is that, you know, somebody pursuing a course of action which is ultimately going to fail. And I mean, if they've been, you know, if they've been advised by other people who've tried that course of action and found it to fail, if they pursue that course of action, then you have to start saying to them, well, the consequences are, if you push this, you're going to end up in a worse position than you started. And, you know, and I've known people who've done that and just pursued something, and whether it's through pride or whether it's because they've invested so much time and energy in it, that they feel they have to keep going to the bitter end, and they end up, you know, homeless or whatever, you know, because they just wouldn't stop pursuing a course of action that was going to be ultimately detrimental to them, regardless of how much they believed in it. You know, there's no point following something that's futile.
No, quite
so. Something that's going to work.
I think another point that's worth bringing up, kind of in closing, is something we didn't get a chance to talk with Dave, but it is up on the his Dave Eden statement on the community press group, is that since he set his feet on this path, he's been quite impressed by the number of synchronicities and things that have turned his way to make it easier for him to do something that he wouldn't really otherwise be doing. I think is that the case?
Well, that's definitely the case, because I've been around when these things have happened, and it's just like just pops out of the blue, and you think, you know, well, we were talking about making a documentary on which is a project we're kind of looking at the moment, and there was a chat around his house, and we were just talking about it. He said, oh, I know a guy that does video documentaries, you know, and he put him on to Dave, and Dave spoke to him just like that. And there's other things. We were looking for such and such, you know. And we're looking for a van to do the press things and go around the country and do talks and stuff. Somebody goes, I've got a van, you can have it.
Yeah.
It just, all these things just come together. And, you know, well, maybe somebody up there likes us, you know, or you know, agrees with what we're doing. But what we could do is have synchronicity in the other direction for the people that are trying to impose all this draconian stuff on us, and maybe it'll start rolling back on them. The more it's positive for us, hopefully the more negative it will be for them.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. And out of all of the things that I've come across in the last 2 or 3 years or so, this is something not only that looks good, it's something that gives every individual a chance to join in. And the more of us there are that are working together, the more chance there is that we're actually gonna make some sort of difference. The more people there are working together to instigate change rather than working as individuals kind of in their own little way, the more chance there is of instigating that positive change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they've mentioned we've got nearly 60 people signed up as journalists, or, well, not necessarily journalists, but some of them are wanting to get involved in such things as video editing and stuff like that as well. But, you know, there's a fair number want to write something, but at the moment, none of them's written anything. I think there's a large fear factor there, you know, about writing something and being critiqued over it. But, you know, I've said to people, like, I've written, I don't know how many articles I've written, but it's into the hundreds now, I think. Mm. And, you know, I can look back at some of them and think, my God, why did I write that? It's awful, you know. Yeah. And I've actually taken things down again. I've gone back over and thought, that's terrible. You know, just, yeah. I don't want to be, I've taken it down. And other things I thought, yeah, that's all right. That's actually quite good, you know. Mm. And other things I think, well, I wrote that in a hurry. It's okay. But, you know, whatever. It was good enough at the time. But, people have got to get over the fear of it, because it's a learning curve. You know, you never get good at it. And I'm not good at it. I do. And, you know, I hope people read it. And I know some people do read it, you know, so that's fine. Other people slag it off, but that's fine as well. Everybody's entitled to their opinion and things. But there is a huge fear factor in people actually getting involved in putting pen to paper, or, you know, the keyboard or whatever. And they shouldn't be worried. I mean, basically, all I'm going to be doing is looking at it and saying, and correcting spelling mistakes or whatever, that kind of thing, you know, basic editing. But it's to check stuff for libel and things like that. That's more important. And we don't want anybody putting something up on the website that's going to get them and the group as a whole into some kind of legal argument, because we don't have the finances to defend ourselves against that.
No,
so we've got to be very careful.
We're in enough legal trouble as it is, one way or the other, the way we're being treated.
Yeah, don't dig a hole for yourself. You know, say what you want to say, but say it in a way that's not going to be construed as libelous or defamatory or, you know, whatever. And people say, well, how do you do that if you want to say something? I say, well, the simple thing you do is make it a question, you know. It or put the word alleged in, or stuff like that, just basic things. Yeah. You know, but again, it's a learning process, and I'm sure I'll get many things that I'll have to send back to people and say, look, you need to be careful here. You're going to get somebody knocking on your door.
Yeah.
You know, and just, you know, rephrase this in a certain way, and but not being, you know, not being arsy about it, and just kind of gently kind of saying to people, just be careful.
Yeah.
You know, but don't be afraid to say what you want to say either.
Mm. Well, it seems, you know, to me that, you know, every day on MSI we're covering subjects that really are not known to the general population. We've got people who are very good with words and who can write as well as speak on the station. I know there's other stations around the place that are doing similar work. And it seems to me that this is an opportunity to seek a wider audience, to seek a different audience than the one we necessarily speak to. MSI is growing. A lot of the internet stations are growing, and this seems to me to be an opportunity to try and broaden our scope, as it were. And it seems to me that Dave's plea at the end there, before he went away, to get involved, seems to be the best way to go. There's certainly no way that any of the hosts that are doing shows on MSI are keeping their heads below the parapet. This is just another chance to really have another bat, really have another go at hitting the ball, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, back in the day, I had the dubious pleasure of handing David Rockefeller a copy of a newspaper with my phone number in it. So, you know, my head's well above the parapet. I've changed that phone number since then, but that wasn't a deliberate thing, but there you go. No, I think the time for keeping your head below the parapet's far gone. It's over. I mean, everybody needs to start, you know, standing up and saying enough's enough, and start to do something. Doesn't matter how little it is. You know, we've all got a responsibility to not only ourselves, but to our children and their children and down the line. I mean, it's their future we're talking about. So ours, we've had our lives. We've done what we've done, and I think, I mean, it's not to say there's not a lot of young people getting involved in this, because there are, but it's not enough. And on that basis, I don't know how old you are. I want to ask on there, but I'm 50, And yeah. I think we're of the last generation that really can actually stand up to this because we actually understand what it is.
Yeah.
You know, what we're facing here. We've still got memories of our parents and grandparents who fought in war.
So much as, because I'm in my early 50s, and so much has changed just in the time that we've been on the planet. All that, so much of this stuff has actually occurred whilst we've been here. We've seen it change. I know about you, but I remember a very, very different world from the one I appear to be living in now. What we're seeking is the opportunity not only of preventing our children from being stolen, but of getting our communities back, getting our libraries back, and the main part of that has got to be starting to take responsibility for what's going on.
Well, yes, you've got to take responsibility for yourself, first and foremost, and stop allowing people in very expensive suits to dictate how you lead your life. Yeah. Who are they to tell you what to do? You've got more. I watched, unfortunately, I was actually at a meeting with Dave last night in a venue where there was a TV screen on as usual, and had the unfortunate experience of watching David Cameron give his Conservative Party leader speech, and his wife was trotted out, and I swear she looked like something out of the Stepford Wives with the batteries removed. And she was I don't know what goes through these people's heads. I don't think there's anything there at all. And if if people allow themselves to be dictated to by they're morons. They are morons. They come across as supposedly intellectual, you know, well-bred, blah, 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 genetically perfect specimens. But they're morons. And if anybody allows themselves to be dictated to by those people, then they deserve all they get, really. And that's a harsh thing to say, but it's true.
Yeah.
You know, if people allow themselves to be treated like this.
Yeah. Well, UK Prep has made a good point in a private message to me. He said, tell me, Dr. Rock, how many of the 50 plus people here in the chat box tonight have actually gone to the community press group and signed up for the emails and to keep in touch and to take part of it. I've got no idea how many, but I'd like to echo, I think, you know, Dave's plea that people do put their shoulder to this particular wheel. It really is, as you said, way past time to put our heads above the parapet. And, we've got to grab at what's being offered to us here. I'm very grateful to you and Dave for coming on and putting this stuff across. And I really wish more power to your elbow. Like I say, at the first available opportunity, I'll come along and take some of your training. One of the few things I am actually qualified in technically is the use of the English language. I love the chance to take my pen to paper and see some of it out there to help with any editing that's going on and stuff. The more people I can see in there, the better. That's all I can say. And so, you know, really, thanks a lot for coming on. I'd like to keep up with you. And, you know, perhaps get you back on again as things move on, because hopefully it's going to grow pretty quickly, because it's still quite young, isn't it? When did you start doing all of this?
It's only really, I think I met Dave nearly a year ago now, and it's only really started to take off over the last, I would say, 3 months. And, Dave is a Trojan. He's worked his socks off for this, and, he will make it work. You know, and we're getting a good team around us. But going back to what you were talking about earlier about infiltrators, that's something we need to be very wary of, because there will be people coming, and even if it's somebody trying to write something which has something in it which is libelous, in the hope that we miss it and it gets out there. You know, there's that kind of stuff you've got to watch out for as well. But in answer to your question about people putting their shoulder at the wheel, we've had 3 inquiries on the website, on the email box, directly from MSI this evening, so that's encouraging.
Well done, you 3. Let's see some more of you in there. Thank you very much.
So we've all got to start taking responsibility for ourselves and stop being nannied. You know, I mean, people talk about the nanny state, but a lot of people don't understand just how endemic it is and how much it's actually infiltrated our lives. And it's, I mean, we have government departments for almost everything now. And government's job isn't to do any of that. The government's job originally was only to provide the services which we required, such as electricity, water, and infrastructure, roads, rail. That was it. That was his job. Now they want to come in your home and interfere with your children from the day they're born. Yeah. It's gone too far. It's gone way too far.
Mm, that's
and it's about time we stopped it.
Yeah, very, very strong point to finish on there, Neil. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm going to put another tune on. If you can stay on the line, I'll have a quick chat before we say goodbye. I'm just going to put some tunes on for the people because we're coming up to Freeman Jack's slot. We might run a little. We've got about 20 minutes or so to go. We might run a bit over here. I'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so, folks. I'm just going to put on another tune, have a quick chat with Neil, and make sure that I can continue with this one, because I personally think, I hope and think that it's really worth doing. In the meantime, this is Prodigy and Poison and a Remedy. Back with you soon.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.
There you go, that's just about been Dr. Rock's radio show for this week with Neil Foster and Dave Eden, with what I think and hope is a very, very interesting project for you all. Coming up next is going to be Freeman Jack. I gather he's going to be freestyling and playing some podcasts tonight. Looking forward to hearing a bit of that myself. Hopefully Jack will be all right with us just going a few minutes over, because I've got a bit of a sort of 9.5 minute thing that I want to play with Sasha Stone giving an address to our international leaders on the kind of truth that we really hope it is that we're going to be seeing. In the meantime, of course, I'll be back with you on what is known as Thursday evening next week. Again, not quite sure what's going to be going on. Thanks ever so much to everybody for your enthusiasm and interaction in the chat box tonight. And like I say, I'd really like to encourage you all to try and keep up with the community press group. It's a very young project. I think it deserves support of people who are already supporting MSI. We're all hearing about a lot of stuff. We're encountering people who are having their children stolen. We're encountering people who are themselves encountering all sorts of abuse at the hands of the law. And the main problem that we have, in my opinion, with all of this stuff is the fact that nobody out there appears to know. And I know that many, many of them are turning their faces and turning their ears away from it. But that just means we've got to talk a little bit louder, and we've got to find ways of actually making them listen. We're finding new ways of doing that just by practicing. But thanks to all of you for being there. Big hi to Freeman Jack. I'll be with you in about 10 minutes or so. And I'll be seeing you all next week.
Could I ask the lights just to be taken down for a couple of minutes? And this is not to get too dramatic, but it is to invite us a little closer into silence and into mindfulness. Thank you. I want to address something to our international leadership. And by leadership, I mean those factions, those sectors, those controlling interests that drive each of us, actually, whether we know it or not. Explicitly, one could speak in terms of the presidents and prime ministers and popes of history and of today. I don't believe that that's necessarily leadership. I'm going to address this to what we all regard as leadership, those elites that drive the hologram, that drive our reality matrix. And I want to do so in a state of heart and a state of mind. To our international leadership, a glance at the international headlines anywhere on spaceship Earth, and we are confronted with lies, lies and more lies. And they are spat out by a global media machine which elevates fear and control to the status of salvation. We are informed by a mutant global media machine that terrorism lurks in every corner, that we should not talk to strangers, that the world's food supply is flatlining, that water is running out, that exotic new viruses are emerging to kill us, that our fragile planet is vastly overpopulated, that our resources are vaporizing, that we are in free fall. We must surrender our arms. We must submit to vaccination programs, to your microchip programs. We learn about seed vaults, multi-billion dollar underground military bases, and we witness the continued hijacking of developing nations and their assets, their resources. The continued suppression of real quantum solutions and technologies which could make all the difference, could have made the difference 100 years ago. And yet the common human heart is telling us something quite, quite different. It is awakening, and in that awakening, it's beginning to speak a different narrative altogether, and it's offering us a different code of wisdom. It is a wisdom which invites us into silence, and in that silence, to reflect upon a single word. And that word is truth. Truth about 9/11 and 7/7. Truth about the secret Rouge factions within our military, about World War I, World War II, the truth about Vietnam, Cambodia, Afghanistan, about the world drug trade, truth about communism and democracy, about Palestine and Israel, about the esoteric ritualism that underpins Whitehall and Washington, truth about the real number of missing children in our world, the truth about Little Bighorn, Pearl Harbor, Waco, Oklahoma City, Pine Ridge, Columbine, the Gulf oil spill, truth about the real space program and the origin and nature of the moon, about the murderous nature of all modern vaccination programs, the truth about HIV/AIDS, about the 1939 Cancer Act, about the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, and every other central bank on the planet, the truth about you and me, and where we stand on this precipice. The indigenous flame keepers motion us toward a place of truth within ourselves, and they invite us to embrace a deeper set of values and to tune in to a more resonant song. And this song enters the heart, and it teaches a universal truth that there is no separation. There never was. There was only an idea of separation, which through the laws of fractality birthed another idea of separation, and this idea was never truly ours. It never belonged. And through this journey of awakening, we begin to see that this world is abundant, it's prosperous, and it overflows with beauty and creative expression. We learn that we can cure all diseases without money, without profit, without men in white coats and manufactured toxins. We learn that we can clean our air, our water, and our soil by a few simple measures. That we can positively affect climate with invocations, geomancy, and the conscious application of the sacred. You, our international leadership, are free to join us in the galactic celebration as we hurtle toward the real genesis of humankind, as we enter the slipstream of our eternal birthright, our multidimensionality, our DNA upgrade. Join us as we remove our dark glasses and sunscreen lotions, as we look to the skies and salute the majestic solar flares that are not our great enemy, but rather offer us redemption within the principle of love eternal. Join us as we kick off our shoes, those rubber soles which ensure a disconnect between us and a conscious earth, and instead permit our feet to remember the sweet grass, the sand, and the mud of our own physicality. As we rip up the asphalt, the mutant infrastructures, the steel and concrete prisons of our so-called civilization, and honor instead the trees, the breathing soil, and the healing radiance of inner earth. Join us as we evolve into being the only species in the universe that are not required to pay to be on the planet we are born. Join us as we now take a long, hard look at those birth certificates, death certificates, marriage licenses, identity cards, passports, and see where they fit perfectly into a Babylonian business plan, a business plan which defines us by literally trading our lives on the floor of stock exchanges. Join us as we pull the drips from our arms and kick away the crutches, spit out the sodium fluoride and the poisons fed to our air, our water, and our food supply. Join us as we reject the needles, the probes, the drones, the x-rays from violating the sacred groves of our beautiful bodies. As we transcend the false reality constructs of fear, protectionism, defensiveness, manipulation, control, and despair. Listen closely to the chorus of the awakening human heart as we command a decommissioning of the mad, bad trillion-dollar war machine, and where we demand that you exchange it instead for a blessed chance at prosperity, at abundance, and a bright new world, exploding not with atomic clouds, but with human creative potential. So, as we cup our hands over the flickering flames of remembrance of who we truly are, and gently blow that fragile flame into a roaring inferno of renewal, of upliftment, of enchantment within ourselves and with ourselves, with one another, with our earth, and with our true divinity. Join us as we cross the great event horizon which looms in front of us now, in the closing of these ancient cycles. As we remember ourselves within this dream, and in so doing receive the true gift of life, the true Holy Grail, the most precious golden key of them all, which is the gift of unbearable love toward ourselves and toward one another. Join us in this place, in the true zero point within the human heart, where you will find only love. Thank you. I am the chairman, along with you. I beg you all be seated. Thank you. Let the games begin.